Tomorrow marks the 100th anniversary of Justice Louis Brandeis's confirmation to the U.S. Supreme Court. Cited as one of the most famous and influential justices ever, and his life and legacy are the focus of a new book entitled Louis D. Brandeis, American Prophet. Joining me is author Jeffrey Rosen, also president and CEO of the National Constitution Center and professor at George Washington University Law School. Jeff, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
It is great to be back.
You cite in the intro that this certainly isn't the first or only book, but more appropriately, an abridged version of the life and legacy of this esteemed justice. What compelled you to focus on him?
Yale University Press has a great series called Yale Jewish Lives, and they asked me to write about Brandeis, and I jumped at the chance because this great man is my constitutional hero. I think that he was more influential than any other justice in teaching us about privacy and technology in the 20th and 21st century, as well as being the greatest critic of what he called the curse of bigness in business and government since Thomas Jefferson.
Nominated by then-President Woodrow Wilson, Brandeis's confirmation process in 1916 was bitterly contested, in part, as you alluded to. I believe he was the first Jewish nominee and first Jew to serve on the court, but perhaps at least as much, if not more so, because he had quite a record coming in.
He did. It was both Brandeis's religion and his crusading opposition to oligarchy and monopoly that caused the opposition. There was some anti-Semitism in the air, but the real source of the opposition was the fact that he had infuriated the most powerful oligarchs in the country, in particular J.P. Morgan, the target of Brandeis's brilliant 1913 book, Other People's Money. That book criticized Morgan and other oligarchs for the reckless risks they took with other people's money, leading people to invest in complicated financial instruments whose value they couldn't possibly understand. Sound familiar? Brandeis would have predicted the crash of 2007. And Brandeis said that this was the result of oligarchic connections between investment banks and commercial banks, and his criticisms led to the Glass-Steagall Act in the New Deal period, which separated commercial from investment banking for several decades until it was dismantled in 1992 and led in part to the crash of 2007. So this amazing prophet, this fiery critic of corporate bigness, was prescient in predicting our crashes and also inspired some of the reforms that helped to avert them.
As you mentioned crashes, let's now go back and note that he was a first-generation American, a father, a businessman, and during an economic downturn, the father up and took the family back to Europe for a few years. He didn't have a college education, but somehow graduated top of the class at Harvard Law.
The highest grades in the history of the school. Apparently, the record remains unbroken, and he really was brilliant. As you said, he went to school in Germany, in Dresden, where he learned German, which he spoke throughout his life, and said that that really taught him to reflect on the importance of facts. And he learned that you could change your mind by reflecting on facts. That focus on facts, which he absorbed in Germany, became the basis for the famous Brandeis Brief, which was a collection of facts and industrial reports and statistics that Brandeis presented to convince the U.S. Supreme Court to uphold maximum hour laws for women.
That was a new methodology at the time.
It never had been done. People instead just cited case law. But he said, it's a pride of my life that I've never been bested on a matter of facts. He called the Brandeis Brief what every fool knows, but it was so inspirational that it inspired Thurgood Marshall to write the famous brief that convinced the court to strike down school segregation. And it also inspired Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who I had the honor of interviewing for this book. And she told me that the Brandeis Brief inspired her when she wrote her famous briefs attacking gender segregation in the 1970s.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg, also Elana Kagan and Stephen Breyer are also cited as citing Brandeis's primary influences in their jurisprudence.
Yes, he is a hero to all three of these justices. Justice Kagan calls Brandeis's opinion in the Whitney versus California case the most inspirational free speech opinion of the 20th century, which I agree that it is.
Refresh my memory on that case.
It's an amazing case. It was a case involving a mild criticism of it was a racial segregation that the woman was arrested for denouncing and supposedly inciting criminal violence under this very illiberal California criminal syndicalism law, which she was arrested under. She's convicted, and Brandeis writes this path-breaking separate opinion that is basically the most beautiful defense of the purposes of free speech in the 20th century, as well as the most rigorous protection for free speech in American history, one that the Supreme Court eventually embraced. So the protection is this. Brandeis says you can only ban speech if it's intended to and likely to cause imminent violence. That was an extraordinarily protective standard, which the court had not embraced before, although Jefferson and Madison had flicked at it in their Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, which criticized the Adams administration for criticizing its enemies for truthful but embarrassing speech. But then Brandeis gives this beautiful defense for why it's important to protect so much speech. And it's rooted in his Jeffersonian faith in reason. Brandeis believes that as long as there's time enough for deliberation and discussion, then the best remedy for evil counsels is good ones. He has so much faith in the power of citizens to engage in reasoned discussion that he thinks that even the most hateful and embarrassing speech has to be part of public discourse unless there's no time for discussion because violence is about to erupt. And then he has this incredible passage where he talks about the duty of all of us to develop our faculties of reason, a beautiful Jeffersonian phrase. He really thinks that public discussion is not only a right but a political duty. It's a very idealistic notion of free speech.
Though his was an evolving view of free speech, we first learned that at one point he was interested in protecting the rights of those who might be subject to slander.
He did. It's a remarkable evolution that he and Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes underwent. They had joined a majority of the Supreme Court in upholding the conviction of all sorts of critics of World War I, including, of all people, Eugene V. Debs, the socialist candidate for vice president in 1920, who's literally sent to jail for standing up and giving a mild criticism of the draft. And he's imprisoned, and the Supreme Court, Holmes and Brandeis agreeing, upholds that conviction because under the standard that prevailed at that time, you could be jailed if your speech had a bad tendency, a tendency to incite opposition to the draft. But then Brandeis and Holmes changed their mind, and they were moved in part by a really influential series of articles that a Harvard law professor called Zechariah Chafee wrote over the summer of 1919. Brandeis is also really distressed by the response to anarchists after World War I, and he says, I detect a new Torquemada in the land. Basically, he doesn't like the excesses of the Wilson administration in responding to its critics. So in that spirit of changing your mind when you reflect on new facts, he changes his mind. What's so interesting is that Holmes and Brandeis changed their mind for different reasons. Holmes was a nihilist who basically, because of his experience fighting in the Civil War, where he was almost killed, wounded three times, believes that people have to be able to say whatever they like, because unless the strong can crush the weak through words, then open violence will result. He doesn't have faith in the ability of truth or reason to result. He just believes in the marketplace of ideas because he thinks the alternative is open violence. Brandeis is much more idealistic for the reasons I said, and therefore I think his defense of free speech is really more inspiring and ultimately has more faith in the power of citizens to educate themselves. Holmes had contempt for what he called the thick-fingered clowns we call the people. Brandeis has great faith in the power of self-governing people to develop their faculties.
Some would say that's part of his idealism, thinking that people can self-educate. What form would that have taken then, and what form would that take now? It seems that so much of our news and views comes from almost a rooting interest. I like conservative points of view. I'll watch Fox. I'm a liberal. I'll watch MSNBC. It almost seems like sport now rather than objective news gathering.
It's absolutely true. And at the end of the book, I try to channel Brandeis on news gathering and the internet, asking my favorite question, WWBD.
What would Brandeis do?
What would Brandeis do? I think he would have had mixed views about the internet and news gathering. On the one hand, as you say, the internet seems to encourage the kind of echo chambers and filter bubbles, to use Eli Pariser's phrase, that is the antithesis of the kind of reasoned discourse and the consideration of opposite points of view that Brandeis thought was necessary for the discovery and spread of political truth. On the other hand, he would surely have been excited by the notion that everyone with Wi-Fi now is a potential journalist, that the possibility, if we're just disciplined enough to expose ourselves to different points of view, is staggering and exciting.
You say aspects of his focus and his cause resonate with libertarians, other parts of it resonate with progressives, and that also, by contrast, there are parts of his legacy that don't work for those opposite ends of the spectrum.
Yes, it is interesting. Why is it that this great man is not more centrally cited in the election of 2016, where, after all, attacks on the banks are everywhere? I was disappointed to see Senator Sanders attributing his proposal to break up the banks to Theodore Roosevelt and not Brandeis, because actually it was Brandeis who wanted to break up the banks. Roosevelt wanted to regulate them. But the truth is that all of the major candidates today, Sanders, Clinton, and Trump, are more Hamiltonian. Not so surprised. Hamilton's the rap star of the moment. We're all Hamiltonians now. But that big government preference doesn't jibe with progressives who don't like corporate bigness but don't share a similar suspicion of big government. By contrast, the same libertarians who don't like big government and prefer states' rights sometimes lack a similar suspicion of big corporations. So with Brandeis, you get both pieces of the puzzle. Brandeis believed that both big government and big business were threats to individual liberty because only in small-scale businesses and communities could people master the facts that were necessary for self-government. So this is an attempt to really resurrect this very, very inspiring Jeffersonian economic populist tradition. But now that it's really setting off a firestorm in the country and there's this strong current of anger at the economic dislocation wreaked by the big banks and big government, I think resurrecting Brandeis and his criticism of bigness is more relevant than ever.
You cite free speech as his most enduring constitutional achievement. So WWBD, let's now invoke the Citizens United case. Where might he have stood on that?
Well, I asked Justice Ginsburg that question, and she was unequivocal. She said he would not have been a fan of Citizens United, not at all. So Brandeis...
Free speech does not extend to corporations and special interests in that sense?
No. In fact, Justice Stevens, in his Citizens United dissent, quoted Brandeis's crusading dissent in the Liggett and Lee case, which is nothing less than a history of the modern corporation and of attempts to regulate it. And Brandeis said, since the time of the founding, there's been the suspicion of monopolies, a belief that corporations pose threats to individual liberty, a belief that the founders sought not... economies of scale, but inefficiencies in order to protect liberty, and a belief that great corporate power posed oligarchic threats to liberty. So, no, I think that for Brandeis, it's almost a natural rights view of free speech designed to entitle individuals to develop their faculties of human reason. The idea that that extended to corporations, I think, would not have persuaded him.
Louis D. Brandeis, American prophet. Jeffrey Rosen, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you very much indeed.
Author Jeffrey Rosen is president and CEO of the National Constitution Center and professor at George Washington University Law School.